Most of you don't know what this is. This is called hope. I brought my egg timer so I can keep track of how long I preach, because I struggle with that as an old guy sometimes. And so I just push the button, and now you have hope. Sometimes when I get preaching, I'm thinking about what I'm doing, and I forget about a clock. And brethren have been very kind and patient through the years about that. But it's something that I work on, and it may not seem like it, but I try to do that. And I don't know whether I need to give more thought to what I do. There's a friend of mine that died here a couple years back. He was a very astute guy. He taught history, and one guy said, "I'm just got so much stuff I can't figure out what to teach. It's just so much material." And my friend said, "Oh, it's just getting easier for me. I just figure out what's important out of all this and tell them." So it's easier than it ever was. And so sometimes I just have to figure out what's most important and deliver it and be done with it. I used to work at a grocery store when I was young, and in high school, and then when Deborah and I were in college. And I was telling Michael this morning the problem with the subject that we're going to be talking about this afternoon, and really the next couple evenings, is it's like putting 10 pounds of sugar in a 5-pound bag. There's just so much that could and should be said. And so I'm going to get started here, and we're going to go forward the best that we can. When Michael and I spoke, I had talked to Mike earlier, and Michael, and he wanted to ask if I would talk about parenting a little bit while I was here. So I agreed to do that. But I am convinced that this lesson is a foundation lesson for parenting. And that's the relationship, as we think about in the home, the husband and wife. As you look at the world, marriage is a mess, and things are just upside down in so many ways, which we'll not even start to talk about. And I just want to put a disclaimer up front. I don't know where you are at for the most part. I don't know your background. I don't know the situations for the most part. If you're struggling or something of that nature, I'm not trying to throw anybody a weight when they're struggling in water to try to make this a greater burden. The purpose of this lesson, I believe, is to just express some things that are very important, critically important, and to help those that are in the midst of this. And I think that the principles that we'll talk about here apply as well as we think about being grandparents. And many of these things, as our family relationship continues on, it's a very, very important thing. Most of us remember, Jesus says that if a house or a kingdom are divided, they will not stand. It is God's desire that in our homes that we come to a sense of unity, and that we are not a divided home, but that we are in this together. And that's what God planned and God prepared when he made man and woman in the beginning. And we don't have time to talk about Genesis 2, but when Adam was made and these animals brought before him, I think a part of that is, look, there is no solution here. And so God is providing a partner. My translation says a help meet. And that just means an answer corresponding to, or an answer suitable to the situation. And it is not good for man to be alone. And so God says, I am going to make a partner, a suitable sidekick for my American vocabulary, a partnership here that will help and make this a much better situation. That was God's plan. But Adam needed to know that, and we need to know that. And so as we look at this, one of the great questions that we ask is, who shall I marry as a young person? And I had two of my granddaughters had driven down from Roanoke to spend the weekend with us. And Sarah, our oldest daughter of Brent and Rachel's, our daughter, we were driving home and was talking about, you know, how important it is who you marry. And I thought about something I'd never thought about before. And I said, you want to look at the parable of the sower. You don't want to marry someone that's on the sidewalk. You don't want to marry someone who's on rocky ground. Their roots are not deep. They just initially say, oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to be a Christian. Or someone that comes from the thorns, whose ties and affections and philosophies are of this world and not of humbling himself before God. You want to find someone that has a good and honest heart. that will serve God. That's the person you want to marry. Now, I've never thought of the parable of the sower like that before, but I can't think of a better way to express it than that. When our daughter and son-in-law were dating, and it was approaching a time where they were serious, and they were serious by this time, we were driving through Illinois weather in December. It was cold and it was blowing. We're headed down, I think, to Tennessee. And our son-in-law now asks for Rachel's hand. And I just break out laughing because, I mean, we are out in the middle of nowhere in the cornfields with blowing snow and about 10-degree weather. I said, you chose a great place to ask. I kick you out of here. It's not going to be any fun. But, of course, I told him we would be honored. But here's the one question. Ask him, and I'll leave this. Will you help Rachel get to heaven? That's really been our purpose, is we want our children to make it to heaven. And will you be committed to help her do that? And that's what he's been committed to do, and I'm thankful for that. But what I'm trying to say is who you choose as a mate is a powerful thing. Now, at the end of this lesson, I'll have some other things to say about that, because sometimes the relationships aren't what they need to be. Sometimes a person becomes a Christian and they're with someone that's not cooperative and challenged there, or someone that has obeyed the gospel of Christ, but they're not really humbly committed to God. And so that is challenging, but we'll talk about that at the end of the lesson. And again, consequently, I've got to move forward here because I said I have given you hope. This is a matter of companionship. You're going to share life. It is not good to be alone. You leave mother and father, and you cleave to your wife, is what God expresses in Genesis chapter 2. This idea is to be welded together. It was used to talk about papyrus. It's like we think of plywood, where the layers are glued together, and you just tear that thing up because you can't separate just a little. And the idea of being bound together, and as the proverb writer talks about, and Malachi uses this expression, the companion of her youth or your youth. God's intention was one man and one woman for life, that we are bound together. Now, let me say this. There are challenges that come along. And from that, in Malachi chapter 2, where it talks about the companion of youth there, what does God want from this? He wants godly offspring. There's challenges with the translation there. But I think what he says is, out of this marriage union, what God wants, he says, I hate divorce, is just the previous verse. I want out of this union a replication of who you are as God's servant, and that your children will be influenced by that. And we'll talk about that on Monday and Tuesday night. But as we pull the curtain back, there are just challenges. When Deborah and I, who've been married 46 years, hope I got that right, have been married 46 years, started out, we both had a lot of baggage, and we had to work through things and try to grow. And some days, frankly, it's just challenging, especially for her to put up with me. But that's the nature of life. I'm saying that sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I'm saying that just as dead serious as I can be. When you come into a marriage union, you're talking about two imperfect people, and you're coming together, and we've got to figure out how to work this out. And if I am full of myself and she's full of herself, that's not probably going to happen for a while, until there's a collision where I humble myself. But that's just the reality of it. And that's the nature of relationships. There was something that happened back many years ago. I was around some fellows that had been together in World War II that hadn't seen each other for lots of years. And when they came together, these two old boys, another guy came in there, it's like they're old, long-lost friends. And I hadn't seen each other for so, so long. And the reason is because of what they had gone through together. And I'll just tell you, as an old man, that's sort of how it is in marriage. There's no other woman in the world like this woman, especially to me, because she's my partner, and we've lived life together. And we've gone through the ups and downs, and we're going through whatever challenges there are. And some of those heartaches, some of those that you've gone through, that gives a richness to what happens. Marriage is a crucible. It's a test of our character. Again, they all have challenges. There's a statement made by Henry Ford that Weight Watchers has altered and Dave Ramsey has altered, but it says something like this: if I always do what I always did, I will always get what I always got. And in order for things to be different than they are, I have to decide now to make some changes. What do I need to do? How do I need to go forward? Sometimes I can do that at a run. Sometimes my knee hurts and my back hurts and I'm out of breath and I just have to sort of go at a slow walk. But the thing is, where I am, I need to go forward to where I need to be. And so as we share life and as we work through those things, hopefully we'll be able to make progress. Two imperfect people come together and we're working at making repairs in our life. And as we say sometimes, it is a work in progress. Some people use that as an excuse. They just say it's a work in progress. I can just keep living flawed like I am and I'm not really going to work at anything. But that's not what that means. A work in progress. The question is, am I making progress? Am I going forward? I may be inching forward, but am I moving in the direction that I need to? And in a marriage relationship, that's what we need to do. Wherever we are, younger or older, I have some friends that their parents are gone now, and I'll just keep it as general as I can. And they were just sort of at each other for years and years. Finally, they weren't Christians. And they got finally in their 50s and said, this is crazy. And so they figured out how to get along with each other, and they enjoyed those last few years reasonably together. But the thing is, why did we act like this all these years and be so self-willed? Oh, that doesn't make any sense. And so we just want to work through and make progress the best we can. As I was thinking about this, it's like I say, trying to put 10 pounds of sugar in a 5-pound bag. When you're talking about this, or you're talking about parenting, these kinds of things, you can't say everything that needs to happen. It's like driving a car or flying a plane. A lot of times you fly by the seat of your pants. Say, oh, what could? Well, we'll do the best we can. But from the knowledge that we have, and when we know what we need to do and what's right. When you're flying, sometimes you may feel like you're going one way, or there may be optical illusions. But when you start looking at the instruments, you know, here's where I need to be, not over here. And so as we go through this, we take God's word. And here's the real question. In this situation, right now, today, this hour, in relation to my wife, or to my children, or to my grandchildren, what would God have me to do? That's the question. That really is. As I deal with this situation, as you deal with this, how would God have me to respond? What would God have me to do? I'll tell you what he wouldn't have me to do in any circumstances, be selfish and self-willed and so forth and so on. I humble myself to try to do his will, and I have done that very imperfectly. I'm pulling the curtain back here. I was a slow work in progress, and I'm still working on it and will be till I die. Often what we do is we talk about it's important who you marry. We're looking for the perfect mate, but often much more interested in having than being the perfect mate. And what I need to do is set my goal on being the perfect mate. I can't make my mate what she needs to be. She can't make me what I need to be. My job needs to be is I need to be what God would have me to be the man that God would want me to be. And if I do that, she's going to be blessed by it. And she sets her heart on doing that. But so often what happens is people look at it and they say, oh, I want the perfect mate. I want you to be this and I want you to be that. And that's not the way this works. You can help them and you can encourage them. You can do whatever you can to help that. But they have to do that work. You do yours. And hopefully they will respond in kind. Look at God who perfectly loved his people. What a great lesson. Am I working at being the perfect mate? The attitudes and actions, oftentimes we know, but we don't do. And that's a struggle we have as human beings. Sometimes when I sin, it's not that I didn't know better, but I just didn't do better. And so when that happens, I need to repent of that, and I need to turn my back on that and determine not to do it again. And again, as I said, we come into this with baggage. There was a survey, wrong button at the wrong time here. There was several people surveyed who had been married 50 years or longer back some years ago. And when I heard this material, it was very interesting. Is that the folks who made that The reason isn't because they had different problems. At first you might say, well, the folks that didn't make it had this set of problems, and the folks that didn't make it had this set of problems. What they generally found, and I'm painting with a broad brush here, is they all had the same kind of problems. The question is, what will I do in responding to those problems? That's the difference. And so when a struggle comes up today, when I'm impatient with my wife, or I give her this kind of look that's not pleasing to her, and I need to straighten that out, well, what do I need to do? I need to straighten that out. I need to change. I'm going to try not to do that. I need to ask her, I'm sorry, I was tired. I messed up here. Will you forgive me of that? That's what's mine to do in this situation. And to be resolved to try to do better, not do that. And so whatever the problems, and sometimes they are significant. Sometimes it's unfaithfulness. Sometimes it is treachery. Sometimes there can be major problems. But you look at what God did to his people in the Old Testament, and there is a great lesson. Now, I'm not talking about all the considerations of marriage and divorce here. I'm talking about fidelity. I'm going to make this work. God bent over backwards with his people. One of the things about studying the Old Testament is to see the mercy and the patience of God in the midst of this. In Genesis chapter 4 and verse 7, it talks about Cain and Abel. You remember Cain was jealous of his brother because Cain's sacrifice wasn't accepted, and his countenance had fallen, is what the New American Standard says. And I know the New American Standard translates it a little differently than some translate, but I think it's spot on. Why are you sad? Why has your countenance fallen? And he says, if you do right, will not your countenance be lifted? Sometimes we've just got some attitudes and some things we don't want to let go of. They're just wrong. We're not willing to forgive. We're not willing to let the problems that we had I had with my wife go, and I bring it back. That's just wrong when I do that. Now, I may have to work through it. But as we think about this counsel, he says, if you do right, will not your countenance be lifted? But if not, sin is crouching at the door, but you must master it. Now, that's great counsel. That came directly from God. But when we get good counsel, counsel doesn't take care of anything. Counsel fixes nothing. It gives us information and direction and insights, hopefully, so we can make decisions and make good choices and go forward. With Cain, he made a bad decision, didn't he? And it went downhill from there. And so as we look at all these passages, husbands are to dwell with their wives according to knowledge. And in 1 Samuel 15, here it talks about Saul, and that his disobedience is like witchcraft, just like it's rebellion against God is what that describes. And so we need to choose to do what's right. Well, again, I better keep moving. I'm going to sort of throw this up quickly because of the time factor. In Ephesians chapter 5, what we find is a text that talks really about Christ and his church. That's what Ephesians is about. And he takes the matter, I believe, in Ephesians chapter 5 and says, here's how it is with marriage, to help you understand how it is with Christ and the church, because Ephesians is about Christ and his church. But frankly, as a young Christian, when I read that, Ephesians 5 sounds more like talking about marriage to me than the church. But he says, I'm telling you, I'm talking about Christ and his church. But in the marriage relationship, husbands are to love their wives, and wives are to submit to their husbands. And for the first number of years that I was married, the light didn't come on. I talked about, think about submission, and I need to make my wife be submissive. No, the Bible doesn't teach that. My wife is to be submissive. That's how the Bible always expresses it. I'm not to make my wife to be submissive. Now, I'm going to do everything I can to help her. But it says, wives, submit yourselves to your husband. Again, I may make that harder or easier for her. But it also talks about, as I said, husbands, love your wives. And I'll talk about John chapter 13 in our study, either Monday or Tuesday night. But when it talks about husbands loving your wives, in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 8, it uses a series of verbs. And verbs give us action, state of mind. And it says that this is the way that love thinks, and this is the way that love behaves. That's what those verbs are expressing. In the midst of this, he's talking about the relationship of brethren with each other and over the struggles of spiritual gifts in these chapters. But this is an application to every avenue. The Bible talks a lot about loving one another and loving our wives and loving our husbands. Actually, it doesn't talk so much about wives loving husbands. It tells us husbands, love your wives a lot. In Titus chapter 2, it says that wives are to be warmly affectioned towards their husbands and their children. It uses the word philos instead of the other word agape, as it talks about older women teach younger women that you love your husbands and you love your children. And the word philos is used there. Now, women, wives are to love their husbands. Don't misunderstand me. But I think that you teach them to be warm towards their husband and towards their children is the expression. But in John chapter 13, I'll go ahead and introduce this now. It says that husbands are the head of their wives in Ephesians chapter 5. And in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 6, Sarah called her husband Abraham Lord. And that's correct. And men in your home, you are the Lord of your home. However, that is not what we might think of in the American way of a Lord. I'm some iron-fisted tyrant here. It's the kind of Lord that is described in John chapter 13. Jesus, trying to get the disciples to become servants instead of lords, finally, you remember, wraps himself and he washes their feet. And he says, when you came to me, you called me Lord, and that's right because I am. But I came to you as a servant. That's the Lord, men, that we are in our homes. Yeah, the buck stops here. That responsibility falls on me. I need to lead my home spiritually, not my wife. Now, she has an influence, but that falls on me. But the kind of Lord that I am is I'm a Lord that is a servant. I'm serving the good of my wife. I'm serving the good of my children. It's not self-serving. It's not this, well, bring me the tea, I'm the boss around here kind of old illustration. Demonstrated perfectly in Jesus in John 13. Each partner has wants and needs, and we have to work at understanding those and trying to meet each other's needs. When Ephesians 5 is summed up, it talks about love and respect, that husbands are to love their wives and their wives are to respect or fear, that they're to show this due respect for the husband's role and all, is how this is summarized. This is something that came across my mind many years ago, and I've used it ever since, that God did not make us as a husband and wife to compete with each other. So sometimes it's many years before we figure that out. This is not a competition. God made a man and a woman not to compete, but to complement. And I've asked the brethren at home this is sort of privately, in this sort of tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, which is better, the man's brain or the woman's brain? Which is the best brain? It's when you put them together. God's made man and woman different, the way they think, their characteristics, their attributes, and he designed it when those are meshed together in love as God designed, that you have the strongest entity in mind by the power and the design of God. And it is beautiful, and it is good, and it is able to encompass various things that I could not have done alone. She takes up my slack and weaknesses, and hopefully I do that. But we complement each other in this relationship. There are two major issues that I have on here, and that's going to be, number one, selfishness, and the second is patience or perseverance in what is right. And I've got some quotes down here. The number one character quality of successful people is perseverance. You got to just keep pressing on the direction you should go. Success flourishes only in perseverance, ceaseless, ruthless perseverance. It's not that I am smarter, it's just that I stay with it longer. I think it was Edison or somebody like that made that. Maybe it's Einstein. And then I like this little green thing. You got to be like a postage stamp. A postage stamp just stays with it until it gets where it's supposed to go. We just have to figure out what's right and just keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it until we arrive. James chapter 3 and verse 16 talks about selfishness is of this world. You can put whatever wrapper you want to on it. You can call it whatever you want. But the Bible says that it is the wisdom of this world, and basically it's demonic. It's of this world. It's not the wisdom from above. And again, as we just made reference to in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 a moment ago, it talks about the characteristics of love. It says love is not selfish. And the first several chapters of 1 Corinthians that I happen to be teaching right now back home, what you see is selfishness written all over this, and arrogance written all over this. And so Paul's having to turn that around, and one of the ways that he does that is in this particular chapter. And again, as we mentioned this passage, love is patient, love is kind, is not jealous, does not brag, is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, it is not provoked, it does not take into account a wrong suffered, it does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So here's the characteristics that we see. Whether we're dealing with a husband and wife, we're dealing with our children, we're dealing with our brethren, we're dealing with our neighbor, these are attitudes that we need to carry. And certainly, to the greatest degree, exemplified in our Lord. You want to see what a loving servant is? Look at our Lord Jesus Christ. A friend of mine said, what a man wants is respective response, and what a woman wants is romantic security. And that's an overgeneralization. But at the heart of this, a man wants to be honored as the husband and the head of his home. And if he acts that way, it's going to make it a lot easier for his wife to do that. And he wants her to be responsive to his will. And you know, when he talks, you know, she's listening and she's doing those things. And a wife wants to know that her husband cares for her, that she is tender, that she's more important than his motorcycle, since I like motorcycles, that she is more important than this stuff. She's more important than my fishing buddy. She's more important than my golfing buddy. That she is special. A friend is an elder in South Carolina. Several years ago, I was in a meeting up where he was at as a elder where my son-in-law was at. And he gave me this article, and it was called An Eight-Cow Wife. Interesting title. But it talks about this fellow over in Asia somewhere, and he was known far and wide as being a great businessman. He was shrewd and everything. And so finally, he sees this sort of homely girl one day, and he says, that's the one I want. And so what he does is he negotiates for this deal, and he offers 8 cows for her. And nobody gives 8. You know, I might give 1 or I might give 2. But he offered 8 cows for this woman. And so she became his wife. And she was no longer sort of downtrodden. She knew that she was valuable. He would pay this great price for her. I thought it was a great little article that was written. Husbands, that's what you want to do for your wives. You want them to know that they are that valuable to you. Now, from a man's perspective, sometimes we're sort of boneheads and we don't get that. And sometimes we try to show it, but we try to show it in the way we want to show it rather than the way they want us to show it. And so talk to your wife, get to know your wife, and give her security. That doesn't mean that she has to live in a mansion, driving a new high-end Lamborghini or something like that, but that you're going to care for and take care of her. And so those are important things. Problem solving. That, again, as you're dealing with things, problems come all the time. Problems come with the marriage, problems come with raising kids, problems just come in life and work and all kinds of things. But as we think about life, life's under construction, life, me as an individual and as a family, and things that can help my marriage, and again, this is a whole series of things, and I'm going to just try to go through here quickly, and I'll put these up, if I can back up one. Okay, I guess not. We need to build bridges rather than walls, and here are some passages. I'm not going to take time at the moment, but we have problems. Sometimes we build walls. So we need to build bridges and try to work through our problems together the best we can. We need to spend time together. Where your heart is, where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. And so my mate needs to know that she is that important to me, and I need to know that I'm really that important to her, not all her other pursuits as well. It goes both ways. We got to get our thinking on track. And again, the kind of things that we think on, how we think, as a man thinketh, so is he. So we've got to get our thinking on track. We need to learn to touch appropriately. When we talk about raising children, I'm going to talk about that just a little bit. That my children need to see that I love my wife. And I reach her, I put my arm around her. When our kids are growing up, I give my wife a kiss. And I talk sweetly to her because that's how I feel towards her. And I'm not talking about anything inappropriate. But I'm talking about, they need to see that we're connected to each other, that we love each other. And that impacts them. And we'll talk about that in a later lesson. That we need to talk and we need to communicate here. That we need to show respect and honor, as we've mentioned. Now, in a top 10 complaint in surveys is too much screen time and gaming and cell phone time. And especially wives and complaints about their husbands is, I understand, a big deal in this country. I'm not a gamer, but that is a huge, huge problem in our country where people spend lots of time with their nose stuck in a screen. And they're not giving their wife attention. Maybe it's because it's a lot less frustrating. Maybe it's because I don't want to do what I want to do in regard. Maybe it may be a lot of reasons, I don't know. Or it may just be because I've got addicted to something that really does not amount to anything. I don't know if anybody in here likes to golf. I think I saw golf clubs, so I'm picking on golfers. Since I don't golf, I can do this. Golf is stupid. What does it matter? What does it matter if somebody takes his pigskin and runs it 100 yards? One guy said, you get all those big lugs off the field, I'll carry it down there for 10 bucks. You don't have to pay them all these millions. What does that matter? It really doesn't matter. It doesn't amount to anything except of this world. Now, I'm not against golfing. Play away. I'd like to go fish or ride my motorcycle. But the thing is, what happens is oftentimes we get distracted with things that really are not that important in the scheme of things. It may be that I like them and that's what I want to do, but that robs the relationship maybe that I have with my mate. And I'll just say it this way. If my motorcycle gets in the way of the relationship with my wife or my service to the Lord, then I'll go sell my motorcycle. And of the stuff that I own, I always like my motorcycles. But I think you get the point I'm trying to illustrate. We've got to figure out what's important. And we need to put the junk out of the way so we can address the things that are important. So we can give our attention and our time to our mate in this particular subject. And again, this is in the top 10 of complaints across this nation, is that my mate spends too much time gaming, streaming. Goes for women too. I'll say some more about that as we talk about raising children at a later time. In the relationship of the family, what happens is there are troubles that ensue. And as those troubles come, we have to figure out what we're going to do with them. When problems come up, what we have to do is we need to fight the fire and not fight each other. My friend Gary Sandusky used this illustration. He said, you get two people, husband and wife, and in a room. There's no windows. There's no way out. There's a door on the other side, and this fire breaks out in the middle of the room. You're not going to spend your time fighting each other. You're going to fight the fire. He says, that's what you do in your marriage. Problems flare up. Flames come. You don't spend your time fighting each other. Well, here's the problem. Let's put this fire out, and let's get on together and get out the door. Well, that's a real common sense statement to me, and I like it. Back some years ago, my father was telling me about, he was listening to the radio, and they were interviewing people that had been married over 50 years, talking to this one lady. And she said, you know, this is 50 years. That's just amazing. Did you all ever consider divorce? And she said, oh, no. We never, ever considered divorce. Murder, yes. Divorce, no. But the point was, is we are in this together. And we will go for it. I understand there are other considerations that sometime enter in according to the scriptures. But as we look at this, we got to fight the fire. hand in hand with this, what we need to do is work through our problems. I'm going to put these up here quickly, and this is a little solution page that you can use for all kinds of things. In Ephesians chapter 4, it's not talking about marriage, it's not talking about that relationship, but it's talking about putting off the old man and putting on the new. And then what we need to do is not lie. We need to deal with our anger. We need to deal with our problems immediately. Never sponge off of your partner, but you be giving. No corrupt word. That's not what comes out of your mouth, but that which is going to be for their good. This isn't get even to make me feel good. My speech isn't to make me feel good. My speech is to help them, maybe to heal or for have comfort or whatever. And so he speaks of that in here in verse 29. Do not grieve the Spirit of God. When we do what's wrong, it hurts God. The Spirit of God is grieved when we don't behave. That we need to attack the problem and not the person. And the last thing that this text says is you forgive just as Christ forgave you. That's a biggie. And I'll admit, sometimes that is a challenge. I'll not express what I was about to, some situation that just recently came up. But if I can't forgive, there are lots of problems. I will mention this. This person is a newer Christian, he and his wife, and there's a family member, and she's not willing to forgive. She can't get it in her heart. And here's a new Christian. So I've read my Bible enough to know she's in trouble. He just talked to me about this just recently. I've talked to her, and hopefully when I get back, I'll get to talk to her. But man, I've got to be willing to forgive. Now, what that doesn't mean, and I may mention this somewhere, when I forgive, it doesn't mean that I can take a little eraser and erase it in my brain like it's not there. I can't hit a delete button to get rid of that. But what it means to forgive in this way is that I do not hold this debt against you, and I will never bring this up as a debt against you again. That's what forgiveness means. I know God forgave. He forgave David, and yet later the Holy Spirit wrote those things down. There was forgiveness, but it is not brought back as a debt against them. And we have to be careful that the emotional luggage that we carry along with that doesn't weigh us down in a way to harm us. But forgive as Christ forgave. In 1991, I was supposed to go to India for the first time. The Persian Gulf War broke out, and so I had to delay for a year. That's why I remember the year. But General Schwarzkopf was commanding our troops, and he sat in a bunker with a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun. And he stayed secure there for that. When the war was over, they interviewed him. And they said, what about your plan of attack? He said, did you attack the munitions sources? Did you attack their fuel supplies? And he said, no, the first thing that we attacked was the communication centers. Because if they can't communicate, they can't function. Guess what the devil likes us to do? He'll kill our honest, loving communication because he wants to win the war. The idea of communication means to have in common. If I say something and Mike can't hear what I'm saying, we're not communicating. It's probably more the other way around. He speaks, my ears are bad. What'd you say, brother? But there's no, to communicate means we have it in common. I speak, the other person hears. And so these words register in their mind. It comes from the Latin to have in common. There is a sender, receiver. There's the understood message. There are many ways that we communicate in words and actions and gestures. When I was in India, Vijay Benson is a dear friend of mine from way back in the years when I spent there. His wife's name was Matilda. But we were talking one day, and she said something like this. Sweet talk, you Americans, you sweet talk, that's a waste of words. Benson shows me by his behavior that he loves me. Now, she's got that figured out. I'm not saying don't communicate, don't talk, do. But it's more than the verbal stuff. It's more than the talk. It's, I show you that I love you. And so here in the midst of a land of idolatry and poverty at the time, this woman's got to figure it out. And by the way, they have done well. They've raised their family by this time, serving the Lord. And that's good. This is an expression of the communication. Our face tells a lot of stories. And my wife and I struggle with this sometimes because of me. And I'm not saying this in a bad way. It's something I've got to work on. But I'll start to work on something. I get frustrated with it. And she looks at me. She thinks I'm frustrated with her. I just want to break this piece in two and throw it in the trash and start over again. Sometimes I get frustrated and it shows in my face. And so I have to figure out how to work on that. I've just got to calm myself down. There are times I'm going to say, I'm just going to walk away from this for a while. Then we'll go take care of whatever we need to. And I'll come back and be frustrated in a minute when I work on it. But the thing is, my whole point is these are universal communications. I can go to any country. It's one of the things you learn in the military. And Gary Sandusky and I have talked about it when he was in the military. You learn your surroundings and you read faces. You watch what's going on. And part of that, they may not be saying anything. You may not be able to understand the language, but I tell you what. I see certain things going on in the face and I say, I better get out of here. Or maybe I need to reach out to this person. But in our communication, it's not just words that are received. It's also our body language. It's also our facial expressions. We're communicating. But it is a critical part in our relationship. Here's some helpful passages. I love Proverbs 15:1. Partially because I'm maybe wired sort of tight, and so I need this once in a while. I get wound up inside. But it says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Sometimes what I have to do is say, I feel myself getting wound up. I need to calm down here about three levels before I start talking. It's a great passage. Many others. James 1:19, be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. He who gives an answer before he hears, it's folly and shame to him. The one who guards his mouth preserves his life. The one who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. In Ephesians 4:29, we just read a moment ago, made reference to a moment ago, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. We mentioned Ephesians chapter 5. I'm going to push here. But it tells us that husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church. It says there that he cherished it. This word is only used one other time in the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 7, when it talks about a mother who has that little baby, and she's just tenderly cherishing. You know that warmth. You walk around to a mama's got that little baby, and you see that glow and that protection. You ever hear anything like you don't get between a mama bear and her cubs? Okay, but here is this tenderness. This is the word in 1 Thessalonians 2, and I've got a definition from W.E. Vine here. The word comes to heat, to softly heat, then to keep warm, as of birds covering their young with their feathers, to cherish with tender love, to foster with tender care. This is the word that God, by the Holy Spirit, through the Apostle Paul, used to describe your love and my love for my wife, for your wife. This warmth, this tenderness. Remember about love and respect back there earlier on? She wants that warmth, that respect, and she wants security. This word describes that. That I let her know the best that I can. Sarcasm and a critical spirit crush warm feelings. And pull the curtain back. I grew up in sort of that world. I had to learn some things. And I'm going to talk to you about this with the raising of children. There were some things that happened in my life growing up that were not healthy. And I had to make some decisions about that. I'm going to stop this cycle of behavior. I'm going to do something different. That's not what normally happens. What happens is we replicate what we've learned and what we've seen, and we replicate that again. And a lot of times that's really messed up, but we do it again. We keep passing. The Word of God says, no, look, you don't have to keep thinking and behaving this way. You can make this change. We break this cycle of events. This matter of sarcasm and a critical spirit crush this warm, tender relationship that God described that a husband is to have with his wife. And again, I don't have time for this, but the intimacy of the marriage relationship between a husband and wife, in Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 15, it literally uses this word intoxicated. And I'm not going to read that text. It's just very open. It talks about the intimacy of the same thing that 1 Corinthians 7 talks about. And it talks about the demands to be satisfied in relationship with his wife there. But what he says is, my New American Standard says, you be exhilarated. But in the footnote, it puts intoxicated, literally. And the ESV has taken that over and put it in the text. It means that a man is to look at his wife, that she is intoxicating to him. He sets his mind and eyes and heart on her, and she thrills him because that's the choice that he has made. That's what this describes. Eating and drinking. Rules for the bedroom. Quit worrying about pleasing yourself. Set your mind on pleasing your mate. Be intoxicated with her. Don't go there. The last part of this chapter that talks about that talks about the strange woman and being seduced by the adulteress, by a prostitute, or by some other woman. Don't do that. And we live in a time where the plague that we have on top of so many others is pornography. It sometimes, I'll be respectful, among older folks, we haven't talked about it. We haven't dealt with this stuff. But it is a cancer that is absolutely eating our country. I was asked to be a part of a lectureship back probably 15, 20 years ago. And as I was preparing for some work in Galatians chapter 5, I ran across some information about folks that were called promise keepers. There's a denominational group, and they would just be men that would gather large numbers of men and say, we want to be better fathers and better husbands. We want to be godly men. And they did a survey, and this is 15, 20 years ago. 53% of the men in that promise keeping gathering had viewed pornography within the last 3 weeks. And that's back before the technology had just ravaged our country. The statistics as a nation are much worse than that now. It is an addiction. There's a book called The Pornography, The Addiction of the New Millennium. And it talks about the brain-changing chemistry. And it is a serious problem. Proverbs 5 deals with that. Not pornography, but the relationship. You be intoxicated with your wife, with your husband, with your mate. You set your eyes and your heart that you love them, and you're going to work at doing that. And that is a critical part. It wasn't for some time until I realized how much the book of Proverbs, the first 9 chapters, is talking about young men and young women and giving them admonition. And again and again and again, it talks about stay away from the strange woman, from the adulteress. It spends as much time talking about that as anything in the first 9 chapters because it has always been a problem. These passions are real. They are powerful. They have plagued men and women through the course of time. God warns us, and the devil uses them against us. To say it the way that the Corinthians said in 1 Corinthians 6, if you're hungry, you eat a meal. If you have some other desire, you fill it as well. That is the spirit of our age. But it is not the spirit of God. What happens is no affection, no intimacy, which makes for no more affection, less intimacy, and it becomes a spiral cycle going downhill. But we have a choice in this, as we studied this morning. We can choose to change that. Marriage is worth it. It's worth the sacrifice. It's worth sacrificing yourself and maybe some secondary things. It is absolutely worth it. Last basic chart and then an invitation chart will be right behind us. What happens if I find myself in a marriage relationship and I'm drifting? Well, he says about faith in Hebrews 2, if you find yourself drifting, you pay much closer attention to what's right and you get back there. If you're not where you need to be in your marriage relationship, then you pay attention to what God says is right, not what your country, not what the female or the male race, not what the news media, not what your iPhone says. You go back and do what God said in his word. Hit delete on all this other junk. If you're drifting, go back and do. In life, what happens, it's really easy early in life to get busy with work and hobbies and self-interest, and middle life busy with all the above and children, and then later you get an empty nest and you say, who is that person over there? I don't know them anymore. And I have had multiple people over the course of the years tell me that their wife was busy raising children, and finally when it got to the time those children were coming out of the nest, it's sort of like, look, I haven't had time for you. I've been busy raising kids. Who are we? Don't do that. Now, you give the attention your children need the best you can. And I know we're talking about juggling a lot of things, and life is crazy. But you love your mate. And if you find that you're not doing what you need to that way, just say, okay, X marks the spot. We'll start here. Sweetheart, will you forgive me? I know I've been distracted. I know this. And I just want to do what's right here. Or what can I do within the realm of my responsibilities to make this right? And then hand in hand with that. Sometimes they're just mates that are not responding. In 1 Peter 3, it talks about a woman who has an unbelieving mate. And I'm just going to boil it down this way. See, you just live it better. Your faith needs to live, and you need to be pure and chaste. That's how you need to dress. That's how you need to think. That's how you need to behave. That your husband will be one without a word doesn't mean you can't talk to them. But your example, remember powerful things last hour, a few hours ago? Your example says a lot. And I tell people this passage works not only with a husband that's an unbeliever to his believing wife, but it goes the other way around. And I know of examples of that where a wife was not a Christian, her husband was. And over the course of time, eventually she did, but he was just steady. And it works in our homes. About we live the life. We'll talk about that the next two nights. You do what you can do. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 through 23, Eric talks about servants, but listen, you may have a mate that just does not treat you right. But what you do, number one, is you choose to do what's right. And you remember that you're not only just doing it for her. Or in this case, you're not doing it because you have a master that's not good. You're serving someone higher than that. And when you treat your husband or you treat your wife the way that God would have, I am serving God. That's why I do this. And if I come up short, I'm serving God. If that's what honors him, then that's where I'm going to walk with God. There's a much higher calling, a selfless calling. And I tell you what, if you can't reach a person with that kind of patience and kindness and love and selflessness, then you got challenges. But I know many a person who's died with an unbelieving mate who said, I will be faithful. Some of those are, I know folks that are living, and their offspring have become Christians because they said, I'll live the life no matter what. Don't ever sell that out short. There will be mountains to climb on the road of marriage. If you will do it together, view is good from the top of the earthly mountain, and even better from heaven. Thank you for listening so patiently and so kindly. And we got 6 pounds of sugar in a 5-pound bag. I'd like to be able to put 4 more in there.